From 90.5 WESA, I'm Kevin Gavin, and this is The Confluence.
It doesn't matter if you're a Democrat or a Republican. If you're a mayor of a city, you oppose this president's plan.
The impact of President Trump's budget on Pittsburgh and the state, on human services, jobs, and the environment. Plus, a conversation with NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro.
If we know somebody's presenting us with information that they should know to be true, and they're presenting falsehoods, especially people in power, public officials don't deserve any kind of kid glove treatment.
We'll talk about new challenges for the media in covering the administration and attempts to replace the Affordable Care Act. Also, over the last 6 years, enrollment has dropped at all but two of the 14 state-owned universities. We'll discuss the problems facing these universities and how they're attempting to overcome them. The Confluence follows this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, a conversation with NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, and the state-owned universities facing declining enrollment, decreased funding. How can they be sustainable? But first, President Trump's budget proposal for the new fiscal year that'll start October 1st slashes funding for 12 of the 15 cabinet-level agencies. The big losers, agriculture, labor, state, and the EPA. Housing and urban development would be cut by at least $6 billion, including the elimination of community development block grants. And funding would be eliminated for the National Endowment for the Arts, as well as the National Endowment for Humanities, plus the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Joining us to discuss the impact of the president's proposed budget cuts on Pennsylvania, Laura Olson, reporter at the Washington Bureau at the Allentown Morning Call. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Howard Burns, editor of Pittsburgh Business Times. Welcome, Howard, as well.
Thank you, Kevin.
If you have a question, please tweet us. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence.
Ordinary Pennsylvanians are going to have their lives disrupted by a lot of these cuts, and we have to wait to see. I'm going to be responsible. I don't want to be an alarmist, but I'm not sure how the lives of Pennsylvanians are not going to be negatively affected by what's going on in Washington.
That, of course, was Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf speaking to WESA yesterday. He doesn't want to be an alarmist, but what's the initial reaction you two are getting from elected officials? We'll start with you, Laura.
Yeah, we got a lot of concerned comments yesterday, even including from some of our Republican lawmakers in Congress. In the Lehigh Valley area, there's Congressman Charlie Dent, who serves on the Appropriations Committee, and he wasn't too enthusiastic about some of the cuts that were in this proposal, saying that he didn't like the idea of paying for some of the defense boosts that the president is proposing by simply cutting some of the domestic programs as opposed to other strategies. So this will be a heavy lift. There's a lot of effects in here on a real range of areas in terms of the money that would be coming back to states for some programs that people might encounter on a daily basis, from Meals on Wheels to some of the affordable housing or other community revitalization projects.
Howard, what reaction are you and your reporters getting to the president's proposals?
Well, for example, Kevin Ackland, who's the chief development officer for the city, flat out called the budget cuts a disaster for Pittsburgh. And prior to the announcement of the budget yesterday, that had been a prime topic of conversation at the Urban Redevelopment Association, which Ackland chairs. If you look at cuts in the National Institutes of Health, we talked to Dr. Arthur Levine, who's the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Health Services, and John and Gertrude Peterson, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And he said that these cuts would obviously, his words, decelerate and compromise all that we do. Other people are more confident because they know that this budget is probably DOA. But still, there's a lot of concern out there.
Now, let me follow up with the NIH. Now, so we have money that goes sort of directly to city and counties, and then we have money, federal funds, that go into the region for university research and other things that you were alluding to from the NIH, right?
Well, what I can tell you is that in Pennsylvania's 14th Congressional District, which includes Allegheny and Westmoreland counties, they currently have active NIH grants totaling about $115 million. Of that, the University of Pittsburgh and McGee Women's Research Institute receive the vast majority of the funding. Pitt gets about $84, $85 million, and McGee gets about $24 million. That's a lot of money, and that could conceivably go away.
Laura, are you seeing that as well? So money that doesn't directly go to a city or county government, but agencies, entities, organizations within your coverage area?
Yeah, we talked to a number of social service agencies yesterday. One of the ones I spoke with was a local branch of the legal services network that would see its funding eliminated. Across the state, that they bring in about $11 million in federal funding. And for the local office, they said that was about a third of what they need to operate. They get state funding, some donations from bar associations, some other sources, but trying to make up $1.8 million from some of those other sources in the 20 largely rural counties that they work in northeastern Pennsylvania would be a pretty heavy lift, and they weren't sure how they'd be able to do that.
I want to talk a little bit more about the elimination of the community development block grants, the 42-year-old program. I believe $3 billion in grants were issued in this current fiscal year. Now, city and county governments, they serve as sort of conduits to help provide the services to get the money to other organizations to actually do the hands-on service providing. So cities, including Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, they're going to be hit by the elimination of the CDBGs. Pittsburgh received, I believe, about $12.7 million this year in the grants. Mayor Peduto told us yesterday that cutting CDBG would mean an end to programs, say, to reduce veterans' homelessness, job training, and several other programs.
I think that the president really doesn't fully grasp what community development block grants provide, and hopefully over the course of these next couple of months, there will be enough of an outpouring of support for those that have benefited from them to change Congress into making sure that they remain.
I'd like you both to comment on that remark made by the mayor about understanding the repercussions of eliminating the community development block grants. We'll start with you, Howard, and then Laura, please.
Well, let's first just understand what the CDBG program means for Pittsburgh. I mean, it supports a long list of community needs, such as staffing support for community organizations, road repairs, gap monies for housing rehabs, police and fire department pay, business district facade grants, affordable housing grants, small business loans, and it's played a very key part in helping revitalize downtrodden neighborhoods in our city. I mean, it is, to quote Matt Galuzzo, who's the director of the Lawrenceville Corporation, he calls it the lifeblood of their city, and Lawrenceville, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, has been one of the more interesting success stories in our region in terms of redevelopment and revitalization.
Laura?
Yeah, block grants is one of those kind of jargon terms that folks might not really understand what it's being used for, because it does have such a wide range of effects. I mean, we're talking with local folks in our area about how it's used from anything from street paving to affordable housing to trying to fix up blighted areas to, I think we had to Meals on Wheels is the other thing. You might not hear the words community development block grant and think, oh, that's paying for meals that are going to elderly homebound residents in your area. And so it really allows cities and counties some flexibility to kind of fill in the gaps wherever it's needed. And across the state, I believe the number that we had was that it's about $170 million that was distributed at one of those local levels in 2016.
We're talking about the potential impact on the Pittsburgh area and Pennsylvania as a whole of the budget cuts proposed by President Trump. Our guests are Laura Olson, reporter in the Washington Bureau of the Allentown Morning Call, and Howard Burns. He's the editor of Pittsburgh Business Times. Now, I want to go back to something the administration said and have both of you comment. Howard talked about a wide range of areas of services that were affected by and benefited by the community development block grants. The administration said the CDBGs are not well targeted to the poorest populations and, quote, not demonstrate and have not demonstrated results. Howard.
I would vehemently disagree with that characterization, just like I would disagree that the Meals on Wheels program isn't performing the way it should be. I'll give you a couple of examples based on our reporting. For example, in 2012, the city got a $15 million transportation investment generating economic recovery grant with the Tiger Grants, which are on the block as well. And that grant leveraged the multi-million-dollar investment for the East Liberty Transit Center, where an apartment community with more than 350 units was completed last year. There's also a one-time grant of $30 million, which was a choice neighborhood grant from HUD, that's helping to transform the East End neighborhood of Larimer. And, you know, we've gotten $138 million in new markets tax allocation for the URA, tax credits for the URA. I mean, clearly, these programs, these grants have been vital to these neighborhoods that we're talking about.
And, Laura, I assume that you're getting the same argument from people you've talked to in your area.
Yeah, and one thing to keep in mind is that even if the administration may be a little bit skeptical of these programs, the lawmakers in Congress go back to their communities and they talk to these social service agencies, they talk to local lawmakers who are distributing these funds, and they're pretty familiar with how popular the program is in their area and some of the results it's been able to have. So. One thing to watch is whether this program actually gets eliminated by Congress, which would be a pretty surprising result, or whether it maybe gets a little bit of a cut, and whether this may have been part of a negotiating tactic by the administration as they put out their budget.
Affordable.
One of the things, Kevin, I'd like to add,
please.
Though, that and I agree totally with Laura. I mean, this budget proposal as it is now is DOA. It's not going to happen. But what this is, what was presented yesterday by the administration, and I'm going to use a word that Vox used last night in their coverage, this is a manifesto for the Trump administration. This is a clear message of their priorities. And so even if this budget does not pass in its current form, it still shows you where their priorities are. And it's enough to worry any mayor of any urban center like Pittsburgh.
So one of the other things that is a challenge for cities across the Commonwealth is affordable housing. Larry Swanson of Action Housing said Pittsburgh and Allegheny County don't have other funding options.
None of that work would happen without CDBG and home investment dollars. You simply can't make the financing work. I think that Congress will be supportive of continuing funding these programs, but in the end, there will be some loss of funds.
Is that a concern, Laura, for your coverage area?
Yeah, and affordable housing, again, goes back to some of the community development block grants. That's one of the array of uses that those have been used for. And, I mean, affordable housing is definitely a struggle across the Commonwealth.
Okay, and Howard, affordable housing?
Well, I think it's going to be catastrophic. I mean, and also, there are many neighborhoods where private investment does not come unless there is first funding from the community block grants. So without those grants, you then lose the opportunity to get private money to help with these neighborhoods.
Real quickly, if we might, overall in the budget, three departments come out winners, more funding: Defense, Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs. Any winners either in geographic areas or in sectors in Pennsylvania that you two have seemed to find?
Well, I think that there will be sectors of the manufacturing industry that will benefit from the increase in defense spending. But overall, I think that, you know, this is a state. I think what this budget does is it puts the onus back on the states and the municipalities. And if you look at Pennsylvania and if you look at Pittsburgh, we've been struggling for many, many years, and this certainly doesn't help matters.
Laura?
A couple of others that had popped up as we were going through the budget yesterday were some additional money for opioid treatment. That's something that the state's been struggling with, along with a number of other areas across the country. And this would provide, I believe, about $500 million additional dollars to pay for prevention and treatment programs for. Even though HHS overall was among those taking a hit, there was a little bit more money in there targeted for that specific area.
We have just 30 seconds remaining. I just want to get final thought from each of you, and that is Howard used terms like a DOA and a manifesto. Is that a way for President Trump and his administration to say, see, we tried, maybe Congress sort of nipped away and chipped away at what we were trying to do, but we tried to do what we said we would? Howard, we'll start with you and end with Laura.
I think that there were a lot of promises made on the campaign trail that are not being realized in this budget. Sure, I mean, he said he would be different and he would cut government, and he certainly is doing that. But there's a lot of people that supported him who are going to be directly affected by these types of cuts, and I don't think that they were as savvy about that during the campaign as they may be now.
Laura, the last 20 seconds are yours.
And before they can even get to this budget, which would start for the fiscal year beginning in October, they still have to finish paying for the rest of this fiscal year. There's a spending deadline that ends in at the end of April, and the money to pay for the federal government from May through October still has to be sorted out. So more challenges ahead.
Laura Olson's a reporter at the Washington Bureau of the Allentown Morning Call. Howard Burns is the editor of the Pittsburgh Business Times. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gapp. Whether it's the Obama administration possibly spying on candidate Donald Trump, or the repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act, or contacts between Russians and Trump campaign supporters, or something more normal, such as confirmation hearings for a Supreme Court nominee, it's a busy time for reporters and editors, and probably safe to say a different atmosphere. Joining us in studio is NPR's lead political editor. He is Domenico Montanaro. Welcome to Pittsburgh, Domenico.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay. You've been at NPR about 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Were you sort of brought in as NPR was beginning to gear up for the 16 presidential campaign, knowing how long these campaigns take?
Yeah. I mean, well, that's a big part of it. And we needed to rethink how we were going to do the campaign and make sure that we had various beats covered. You know, we're doing things with fewer resources than some of the commercial outlets, but we still want to tell important second-layer analysis stories.
Okay. And I want to talk a little bit about that campaign and how you deal with 17 GOP candidates. And
very delicately.
Well, yeah, again, dealing with resources and how you deploy those resources and make sure it's effective storytelling. So back in August, the conventions are over, the campaign is in full swing. Are you even thinking ahead to after the election at that point? So we're going to cover the transition, there'll be cabinet nominees, and then we'll gear up for the inauguration. And if you were thinking about that, how different did it turn out to be?
Well, you always have that in the back of your mind. It becomes more crystallized in September and October. By the time the conventions are over, you're really wanting to make sure you have your ducks lined up to cover the general election and those debates really well and figure out what kind of products we want to put out there, what kind of stories we want to tell that are going to really set NPR apart. I think our fact checks and annotations did really well online for that specific reason. Our radio stories were really good because we had people out on the campaign trail picking spots, doing themes from those stories. So it's always in the back of your head that you're going to have to cover a transition. We had to have two plans. We had a plan for Hillary Clinton if she were to win, and we knew because there's a group that actually works on transitions that's funded by Congress, we worked with them early on in late August, early September, to see what was being done so far. And what was being done was that Hillary Clinton had a massive transition team already set up. They had the kinds of implementation to the which sub-cabinet picks were going to be implemented where. We didn't have names, but we knew that those motion that the, that was in the works. The Trump campaign didn't have any of that going. They had a much slimmer down apparatus. Chris Christie, remember him, was ostensibly in charge of the transition for most of the campaign. And then after Trump won, Christie was unsummarily let go. And Mike Pence was said to be the one in charge. So that's when you really started to kind of have to cover it on a day-to-day basis with the transition. But, you know, on election night, we had two stories ready to go, one that Hillary Clinton won, one that Donald Trump won. We had some idea of the direction that they wanted to go because there's no better way to tell how someone's going to govern than how they campaigned.
One more question looking back, because I find it interesting in the approach that you take, because we talked a little bit about just so many candidates. And yeah, I guess you might have been able to. Well, maybe not. Yeah, okay, the day-to-day campaign speech of Ted Cruz, of Donald Trump, of fill-in-the-blank candidate. But you broke it down to rather instead of candidates, more the beats, the types of topics that they would be talking about in their campaign.
Yeah, and I think it's not even so much what the candidates would be talking about, but what the country should care about or was caring about. Mm-hmm. So we really felt like going into the campaign that the country was at an inflection point demographically. I didn't realize just how much that was going to be actually true and how much that would be something that drove Donald Trump, for example. But we wanted to make sure we were dealing with demographics, so we had a demographics reporter, and she would pick her spots, and we would talk about the kinds of stories she could do. We tried to be kind of innovative with what she would do online. We did this thing called the 270 Project, where you could click how much white turnout went up or African-American turnout went down by percentage and margin, and you could see what the path was for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton to win. So we came up with demography, business, data. Those were just some of the topics. And then, you know, you see things like how religion plays out, and we would go and pick our spots with that. We had a few campaign reporters. So when we felt like we weren't getting enough Ted Cruz stories or Marco Rubio stories, we'd sit around and we would figure out which reporter should go out with who. And we'd kind of look there and say, okay, do we have too many Trump stories? Who haven't we gotten out with yet? And that's how we would decide how we got someone where.
Did you have to readjust? You mentioned that you had been talking with people who are sort of designated to help in the transition between one administration and another. But did you have to adjust your thinking, your planning, as the Trump administration was moving in and taking office, just because of maybe a differing relationship between the White House and the media?
Yeah, I had pretty good relationships with some of the Trump advisors and surrogates. I knew a couple of them fairly well. So I wasn't totally concerned about the kind of relationship we would have with the Trump administration. I mean, we knew that there was some level of antagonism that was going to go on because it was something that plays well with the Republican base when you are able to say, oh, the mainstream media is not giving me a fair shot. It's a nice way to deflect when you don't want to have to answer the question. So as long as that doesn't bother you too much, you can still do your job and ask the questions and stick to the facts. The Clinton campaign, it's not like they were totally friendly with the press. So it's not like going back to the 2008 campaign, they also had a degree of skepticism of the kinds of stories we would write and would push back very hard. So I think that they did things more traditionally and certainly put more emphasis on the professionalization of what a normal, typical administration would do. But there's always a degree of contentiousness with any presidential administration.
Of course, if you're not spitting out the rosy picture they present, or if you are not just printing word for word the press release that they give you,
yeah,
of course there's going to be pushback.
And we're also kind of annoying. I mean, you know, journalists do the – we ask the questions nobody wants to talk about at the dinner party. We're constantly looking at the vulnerabilities of a candidate and figuring out how we can ask the toughest question to box them in so that they're not going to be able to wiggle out and we can get closer to the truth. Who wants to do that if you're a politician and you want to present your side of the story?
Okay. So let's talk about some of the big stories that are in play right now and what's your approach to them. And, of course, one of the big ones right now is the replacement for Obamacare. What is the approach to dealing with this? Because you've got, what does it eliminate from Obamacare? Does it keep anything? What are its impacts, both on the monetary side and also on people?
Yeah, I think that this is the first major test of the Trump administration's relationship with Republicans on Capitol Hill, because they can pass this on their own if they want to, because of the complicated process called reconciliation, where they don't need to pass the 60-vote threshold. As long as something is related to the budget, they only need 51 votes. So that means in the Senate, they could lose two. In the House, it's always majority rules, so they could lose about 21. Unfortunately for the Trump administration and for Paul Ryan, who really crafted a lot of this bill, there's defections on the right and defections in the center right. So they're having a difficult time trying to figure out how to get over the finish line. Donald Trump is somebody who's kind of transactional. He's not as ideological, and he's willing to negotiate on some of these things. But it took a real hit this past week when the Congressional Budget Office came out and said that premiums would go up some 15 to 20% under this new plan, that there would be less coverage, and that more people would be uninsured under this plan. So that has been difficult to sell to moderates, obviously, and that's also been difficult to sell to the right, because the right didn't want these, what they see as new entitlements, with this new $100 billion fund that's involved with it, with the new refundable tax credits that are involved. And they just don't want to see extra spending. And then also there's a question now of who it would actually benefit. We're seeing the Kaiser Health Foundation, for example, said that young millennial urbanites who have some money would actually do fairly well under this, and rural, less educated folks would do worse under this bill. Sounds like the kind of people who voted for Trump.
Yeah. We're talking on The Confluence today with the lead political editor for NPR, Domenico Montanaro. I want to follow up on that. You mentioned the Congressional Budget Office numbers described as nonpartisan, but how is Paul Ryan? How is the Trump administration reacting to these numbers? And are they questioning the partisanship or nonpartisanship of the CBO?
Well, one of the tricks in public relations when you have your back against the wall is to cast some doubt on the study or the person that's presenting the information. There's a degree of hypocrisy to that, because Republicans and Democrats have always said that the CBO is the nonpartisan agency that is really the referee when it comes to these bills. Now, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said, hey, well, look, you know, when they estimated Obamacare, they got it wrong. They underestimated XYZ. He didn't have all of his facts exactly correct, but it was enough to present some doubt for the people who want to be able to support Trump. But at the same time, there are enough Republicans in Congress who understand that the CBO is really the gold standard and is what they have to go by.
You mentioned who might benefit under this plan and who might get hit, less educated rural individuals. And of course, states are wondering, Pennsylvanians are wondering how they might get hit. Governors are wondering, what about Medicaid expansion?
Especially Medicaid. Yeah.
I mean, Pennsylvania's wondering about, okay, what are we going to do with a $2 billion gap? We only have a $31.5 billion budget total.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a major issue for both sides. You know, moderates want to make sure that, and Republicans in particular, in those states who accepted the Medicaid funding, want to make sure that that money is going to be there so that they can still continue their programs. This is a major issue for the right, though. Conservatives want the Medicaid funding phased out earlier, and that's one of the areas that Trump seems to want to be able to negotiate on, but House leaders don't.
Mm-hmm. All right, so health care, it is a health issue. It's a monetary issue. There are politics obviously involved. The controversy over the wiretapping allegations. Now, the deadline is Monday for the Justice Department to come up with evidence backing up the president's assertion about President Obama's administration, whether he wiretapped him or not. Is this a personal rights issue, or is this strictly a politics issue, or politics always mixed in?
You know, when politicians have their backs against the wall, they need to find a straw man, and it seems that President Trump, who seemed to like President Obama after meeting him for the first time, is now using him as a little bit of a battering ram to say, what about that guy? You know, and there's this thing called whataboutism that the Soviets used to employ whenever they had something that was bad, that they had their backs against the wall with, and they would say, what about Europe or what about the United States? They used to enslave African Americans in the United States. They even have a word in Russia now for they lynch people over there. So, you know, it's a typical strategy to say, deflect. What about that guy? Yeah, deflect. So there's no evidence so far that President Obama actually ordered any wiretapping. The White House has seemed to walk that back a little bit and say, well, we're talking about the administration and whether or not there was anything. This will continue. There's going to be investigations over it. We'll see if anything comes out of it. But the White House is going to continue to be asked on a daily basis where their evidence is.
Will they just sort of have to get into the executing a government mode and proposing legislation, focusing more on that moving ahead, do you think?
I mean, it might be smart. I mean, they have the numbers. There's no reason not to try to push through some of the things that they would like to help reshape the country. A lot of the chaos is sort of self-inflicted. And if you had the kind of management where you just had an agenda that you wanted to lay out and get past, the problem is right now, healthcare is the thing that's in the way. They want to actually try to vote on this thing next week because they want to be able to go home for the April recess and not have to go to those town halls and hear it from both sides. But that might be difficult to do. Then they want to try to tackle tax reform, and that could take up the entire year.
I wanted to ask you a question about the challenges for journalists in general and NPR specifically. You were talking to a group of WESA listeners, and a woman asked you a question, and it had to do with facts. Mm-hmm. And do people care about it? And she seemed to be concerned that some people just don't care enough about facts is what we base our business on, and she used the term more of a visceral feeling that that's what they cared about. So how do you, as the lead political editor, talking to reporters, deal with if a lot of people agree with that, that it's more about a feeling rather than the fact?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to cover the feeling, too, and make sure that we are understanding of what's the dynamic and the background of that feeling. I think a lot of what we've had is people sorting themselves into their own bubbles and people don't really get each other, and so they're automatically distrustful. I often find, and a lot of our reporters found, that when we would go to rallies, whether it was Trump's or Clinton's or whomever's, they would be initially skeptical of the media. Then they'd get to know us and we'd talk to them for a bit, and they actually were very nice, and they realized that we didn't have horns and we actually knew what we were talking about. So, you know, the more we can do that, I think it's helpful. But we have to make sure that our facts that we present have no holes in them. I think that a lot of people are looking for ammunition now. They're not necessarily looking for those to be convinced of something. And I also think that it's unnecessary for us to be unnecessarily antagonistic. If we know somebody's presenting us with information that they should know to be true and they're presenting falsehoods, especially people in power, public officials don't deserve any kind of kid glove treatment. But when it comes to regular people, and we're talking about facts, there's no reason to throw it in people's faces. But I think that it's important to present the information in a balanced, civil way and try to help them along in something of a journey of discovery, which NPR and WSA do really well, to tell people's stories and bring them along so that we're not presuming back our knowledge, we're not talking down to them, but we tell them how this information came to be and there's no holes on the path on the way there.
Okay, I'm going to quote somebody that I heard recently. You might know him. His name is Domenico Montanaro. He said we have to double down on the facts.
Right. I agree with that. I mean, I, of course.
I hope you do.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that when people are presenting information that is, you know, false, or they're pushing different narratives, the more we can calmly double down close to the ground on the facts, dispassionately present the information, and high up in stories, say if something is false. I think that that is an important thing to do, and that we need to – that's our job. You know, it's the thing that we're most well-trained at doing, and we need to go back to fundamentals.
Okay. Steve Bannon, President Trump's chief strategist, formerly of Breitbart, not long after the inauguration, told the media to keep your mouth shut. So should we heed Mr. Bannon's suggestion, keep our mouths shut, not complain about being shut out of press briefings or not acknowledging questions and not answering those questions? I mean, that's not something the media can win or maybe should not even try to win, but rather speak more loudly and clearly with our reporting.
Yeah, this is, I said yesterday also that my father was a basketball coach for 20 years, and some coaches play the refs in a real sweet way and they're real nice to them, and others are really mean to refs. And we're going to see that more through March Madness, where you're going to see people, some of these coaches incensed on the sidelines. Steve Bannon knows what our job is, but people in power don't necessarily want checks and accountability, and that's our job. You know, we don't need to be disrespectful. We should be civil. We should present the information and be tough, and we're going to continue to do that, and they know that.
Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead political editor. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Coming up, Pennsylvania state-owned universities are trying to deal with declining revenues and enrollment. What changes are in store? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, PASHE, is undergoing a strategic review in an effort to make sure the system has a sustainable future. System Chancellor Frank Brogan has called the current operations of the 14 universities unsustainable. Since 2010, enrollment has dropped overall by about 15,000 students. Only two schools saw increases. Let's talk about the challenge that the state system faces with Deborah Eardley, reporter for the Tribune Review. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Kevin.
And joining us in studio is Bill Schachner, reporter for the Post-Gazette. Bill, good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tweet your questions or comments. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. To both of you, a drop in enrollment, fewer high school graduates in Pennsylvania to draw from, lower state appropriations, higher tuition. Is this the perfect storm, or dare I say the confluence of negative factors? We'll start with you, Deborah.
Well, the declining enrollment was something that they knew was coming. They were pretty sure. They've been following the numbers for the high school graduation. They've been projecting it out a decade or more for years. This was not totally unexpected. Perhaps the decline in revenues with the state subsidies was unexpected, and that coming at the same time, perhaps you could say it's a perfect confluence of events.
Yeah, and it's always been a difficult market in Pennsylvania. In addition to the competition between the public universities, Pennsylvania has just an awfully large number of private colleges. So even when high school graduate numbers were better, it was a lot of competition because of how many campuses were vying for the same students.
So you have a competition, the state-owned universities, the state-related universities, including Pitt, Penn State, Temple, Lincoln, and then, as you say, the private universities.
Right, right, that's true.
How big of an influence do you think is that, Deborah?
It is an influence. They a few years back had a study by McGuire Associates, and they looked at the private universities and they looked at the state-relateds. Yes, they were competing with the state-relateds, but the private universities were able to market themselves differently than the state. The private universities were able to discount tuition, which is a common practice. They have a huge sticker price, and then, oh, by the way, if you come here, we'll give you this much in scholarships and this much and this much and this much. And year one, it might look like they're getting down around the same level as the states. And at the same time, the states have maybe had issues with marketing themselves. As Bill said, this is a difficult market, and it seems like they have an identity problem in many instances.
Yeah, Deb's right. And one additional thing, too, is because the state for a number of years was quite late in getting its state budget together, it meant that the public universities had to wait longer so they could assemble their financial aid packages, which gave the private schools an advantage in that they could deliver their offers to families faster than the publics could.
Now, Deb said something before, and it had to do with the expected decline in enrollment. And how much of this was due to the competition? How much was it that the actual decline in population of the high school graduate age, if you would, Phil?
It's a combination of the both. I mean, clearly, and it varies from county to county. Certainly in southwestern Pennsylvania, you're dealing with declining birth rates. You're dealing with declining high school graduate numbers. Some of the schools have been able to replace some of that enrollment by going out of state and attracting students across borders. But that has been spotty. That's been different from school to school.
Deb?
I think a lot of it was expected. If you were to talk to people at the system office, going back 5 years ago, they were showing me numbers, and this is expected. But at the same time, it comes, once again, we go back to that year. They peaked in 2010, and about that same time, you have a state budget crisis, and every state in the country looked at their universities and said, they have somewhere else they can go to ask for money. If we got to cut, that's where we're going to cut. And Pennsylvania, which had a reputation of being stingy with its public universities. I mean, Pitt and Penn State are typically the two highest-priced public university flagships in the country. The comprehensives, the Pashi system schools, have always been among the most pricey in the country. They weren't being funded at a high level to begin with, and they've never recovered from that.
We're talking about challenges to maintain the sustainability of the state system of higher education. Our guests are Deborah Eardley, reporter for the Tribune Review, and Bill Schachner, reporter for the Post-Gazette. Okay, we've mentioned some of the challenges. Let's talk a little bit about the assessments. So is it a system-wide assessment? Are there individual school assessments? Both? We'll start with you, Bill.
Yeah, it's both, actually. The state system, about a month ago, announced that it was going to bring on a consultant and do a top-to-bottom analysis of the 14 universities as well as the Office of the Chancellor. Some schools, frankly, had already begun similar processes. Edinburgh University, a number of months ago, laid the groundwork to do its own evaluation, and that's now underway. Some of the schools have already announced modifications to their future goals and mission. California University, for one, is going to increase its emphasis on the STEM-related fields of science, technology, engineering, and math.
Mm-hmm. Deborah, you have written about California as well.
Yes, yeah. California's in a difficult position. They are in an area of the state where their draw area has declined dramatically, and they also have financial problems. They had a president for many years who went on a building spree, and they ended up with a lot of debt hanging over their heads. But they also did something, and Bill can recall this: the gentleman who was the prior president raised the bar in terms of admissions, and suddenly he was getting more applications. And I think that's the same sort of thing they're looking at Edinburgh right now, where they accepted nearly everyone who applied. And a lot of these schools are accepting nearly everyone who applies. And maybe it's watering down their brand. It's certainly seems like when you see those admission rates that maybe the pressure is to fill beds and fill classrooms, as opposed to finding students who are a good match.
Yeah, clearly, there's been a trend upward in the share of applicants that those schools have been taking, for the most part, with some exceptions. One additional thing, the state system over the last 15 years or so spent a lot of money, made a lot of investments on both new construction of residence halls, renovations of buildings. They basically created an infrastructure to support nearly 120,000 students. And now, right now, they have almost 15,000 fewer students. And that means that number of fewer people paying tuition, bringing in fees. And just to give you an idea of the magnitude of that, that's nearly equal to the entire population of IUP.
Hmm. Absolutely.
I wanted to ask quickly, as I alluded to but didn't mention, in the western part of the state, only Slippery Rock did not lose enrollment over that six-year period. Do we have an idea of why?
It's a number of things, actually. Slippery Rock actually tightened their admission standards a little bit a number of years ago. They also paired that with a pretty aggressive approach to once they recruit the people they believe are most likely to be able to succeed, they created a pretty aggressive system for intervention the first year, for a first-year experience. Interventions for students if they showed signs that they were running off course academically or socially, and it's paid dividends for them, both in the share of students that they retain and also in their recruiting.
Absolutely. And we've got one of these issues, though, going back again to capacity in Pennsylvania. And I was talking to Sam Smith, the former Speaker of the House, a couple weeks ago, and Sam is on the board at IUP, and he followed the expansion of these universities over the years. And as Bill said, these folks invested a lot. They built an infrastructure for this many students. At the same time, over the last more like 25 years, Penn State was expanding its footprint with its branch campuses. And it's had a lot of the same problems that its branch campuses, the Pashi schools, have. And Sam raises the issue, gee, in Pennsylvania, it's been really nice. We had this wealth, this treasure of higher ed. It brought people in from other states. It educated our kids. But maybe we're just to the point now where we have a surplus of capacity. And how do you deal with it?
Okay, these schools, of course, started out as teacher schools, training teachers. Is there a chance that each of the 14 has sort of a particular focus and do it that way, or is that going too far?
Well, I think in a state like Pennsylvania, that potentially might have possibilities, but higher education is very competitive. It would mean bringing people to the table and really getting them in a position where they're willing to cooperate on programs, where they expand, where they choose not to expand.
Cooperation within the 14?
And also within the other publics, and frankly, even among the private colleges as well.
What do you think, Deb?
I think he's right, and that's one of the things that Chancellor Brogan has mentioned. He came from Florida, where they had a far more integrated system of higher education. Their research universities, their state comprehensive, their community colleges were all part of one unit where planning is going on, looking at if we move piece A here, what happens to piece B? What do we have to do to serve our state well? And not that we need a czar of higher education, but that there hasn't, if you looked at what happened with the branch campuses of Penn State and the Pashi schools and their expansion over the years, it might have been good if people had talked to each other.
We have just 1 minute left, and I want to get a sense of, and add your final thoughts, Bill, but when might we expect the system-wide reviews and recommendation and the individual reviews, and add your final thought? 1 minute.
Well, interesting. These problems have been building for years and decades, but the system and by extension the state has essentially committed itself to at least entertaining recommendations by summer. That's a pretty timetable. Not everybody's on board with the idea that they can actually meet that deadline. One other thing I think is important to keep in mind, I mean, all of these tiers of higher education in Pennsylvania are extremely important. The state system has a unique role in that it is Pennsylvania's least expensive option for a university education, and there are so many students who, frankly, probably would not have gotten a four-year degree were it not for those institutions. So what happens here really matters.
Deb, you get the final 20 seconds.
Without a doubt, what happens here matters. It matters not only to the students, it matters to these communities. In many instances, these schools are the focus of these communities. So, we're going to get that report. It's going to make some recommendations. It might be tighten things up, maybe larger class sizes, especially at the higher level students. It might be looking at specializing and moving things around. I don't think we're going to see universities closing.
All right. Deborah Eardley, reporter for the Tribune Review. Bill Schachner, reporter for the Post-Gazette. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
A final note, a little St. Patrick's Day history for you. The parade of 1956 was officially canceled by the city on Friday the 16th because of an expected snowstorm. However, on Saturday, March 17th, an impromptu parade was held despite 9 inches of snow. The police chief, Maloney, complained about the marchers for having the parade, which had been disallowed by city officials. But then he saw the determination of the 200 marchers. He relented. He gave in. He joined the ranks and marched down Fifth Avenue. That's the Confluence for this week. The engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of the Confluence, Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.